This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Happy Boxing Day, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Yeah, it's the day after Christmas, Boxing Day, the time, the traditional time, as I recall, in the United Kingdom, when people would go through their house, find things that they didn't need any longer, put them in boxes, and give them to the poor. A tradition perhaps we should revisit in the United States, although the number of the poor is increasing so rapidly. I don't know, we'd all be standing outside Michael Milken's house or something. I don't know. It's the we'll have to create maps. You know how they have maps to the Stars homes? We'll have maps to the members of the Bush family and extended family so we can stand outside and say, would you please have some little leftover? Speaking of please leftovers, a young girl last week, 17-year-old girl, went in for chemotherapy to cure a form of leukemia, as I recall. And it knocked out, her bone marrow. They're going to give her a bone marrow transplant. But it also knocked out her liver. Her liver went into failure. And she was fully insured. She had insurance through Cigna Healthcare. And they had a donor. They had a liver that was ready to go. They could save this girl's life. And all they had to do, and this is the part that you never see in-house, right? He says, do this test, do that test. Nobody says, call the insurance company and see if they'll authorize this test. Call the insurance company and see if they'll authorize that test. It is so divorced from the real way that medicine is practiced. So anyhow, it was, will Cigna pay to have a liver transplant for this little girl? And Cigna said, no, that's an experimental procedure. Even though we've been doing it for years in the United States and all around the world, sorry, it's experimental. We will not pay for it. And so the group of the doctors, this Ed Pilkington writing for The Guardian, the British papers are all over this, by the way. They look at us like these barbarians. They don't even have health care. I mean, this is hardly a blip in the American newspapers, but it's a huge story in the U.K., The 17-year-old from Glendale, California, had been in a coma for weeks after complications following a bone marrow transplant to counter leukemia. This is weeks after the operation, her liver failed. Doctors referred her to an emergency transplant. Although she was fully insured and had a matching donor, Cigna refused to pay on the grounds that her health care plan, quote, does not cover experimental, investigational, and unproven services, end quote. This was on December 11th. So her doctors at the UCLA Medical Center, including the head of its transplant unit, wrote a letter of protest. No response. So the doctors went to the family, Sarkisian, I believe is how it's pronounced, their last name, and said, okay, if you guys want your daughter to live, you need to cough up $75,000 because the health insurance company won't. The family didn't have that kind of cash, couldn't raise it quickly. So they got together with nurses, relatives, and friends, and 150 people showed up outside the offices of Cigna, the health insurance company, in Glendale, California. This girl's mother, I should stop referring to her as this girl, Nataline Sarkisian, excuse me. Nataline's mother says, Cigna cannot decide who's going to live and who's going to die. Well, actually, Cigna decides that on a routine basis, as do all the health insurance companies in the United States. But nonetheless, Hilda Sarkisian said, Cigna cannot decide who's going to live and die. The demonstration was amplified by an internet campaign orchestrated by the liberal Daily Kos website and other blogs, then bombarded Cigna's headquarters in Philadelphia. In the middle of the rally, a note was handed to Ms. Sarkisian saying that Cigna had decided to reverse its decision. But at that moment, the girl was dying. And a few hours later, her life support was switched off. Following the teenager's death, Cigna issued another statement. This was issued on the 21st of December, just in time for Christmas. Their loss is immeasurable, and our thoughts and prayers are with them. What about your money? We deeply hope that the outpouring of concern, care, and love that are being expressed for Nataline's family help them at this time. Yeah, and a little of your money would have helped. Cigna, by the way, well, again, quoting from the Guardian, the company recently posted figures for its third quarter performance this year, which showed profits up 22%. Next year, it expects to earn an income of $1.2 billion. Nice. So the question, is this another dimension of friendly fascism, of creeping fascism in the United States? I don't see this even as a healthcare story, because healthcare is symptomatic of this larger thing, this Reagan-esque worldview, which says that the idea of we the people coming together and saying that we collectively are going to provide for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that we collectively are going to provide for the common welfare, that somehow that's wrong, that instead we should turn to the wealthy, we should turn to the rich, we should turn to large corporations and let them make decisions about who lives and who dies. And I think Ron Paul, actually, of all people, laid it out fairly well this weekend. He was on Meet the Press, and he was talking about this kind of fascism coming to the United States.
And we're moving in that direction. We're not moving toward Hitler-type fascism, but we're moving toward a softer fascism. Loss of civil liberties, corporations running the show, big government in bed with big business. So you have the military-industrial complex, you have the medical-industrial complex, you have the financial industry, you have the communications industry. They go to Washington and spend hundreds of millions of dollars. That's where the control is. I call that a soft form of fascism, something that is very dangerous.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, there are many things I agree with Ron Paul about. There are many things I disagree with Ron Paul about also. One of his comments about the Civil War, I agree probably we could have freed the slaves by simply buying slaves and freeing them, and as many countries did. But he wants to take the United States back to a pre-Civil War form of federal government. And I agree, 600,000 Americans was a horrible price to be paid for the Civil War, and that's a whole separate issue. And it probably didn't need to be fought. And at least the way it was. And Lincoln thought it was only going to last a few months when the thing started. In fact, everybody thought it was only going to last a few months when it started, apparently. But the larger issue here has to do, in the case of Ron Paul, has to do with he before the Civil War. In fact, I think it's in Charlie Wilson's War. Tom Hanks makes the comment that prior to the Civil War, we referred to the United States as the United States in the plural form, the United States are. After the Civil War, it was the United States is. Because prior to the Civil War, we had strong states and a weak federal government. After the Civil War, we had strong federal government and weak states. And Ron Paul would like to reverse that. But in all cases, the larger issue here is the question of fascism. Henry Wallace was vice president of the United States under Franklin Roosevelt. He was Roosevelt's second or third vice president, as I recall. His third vice president. His fourth vice president was Truman. And John Gardner, he was the second. Excuse me. John Gardner had been two terms, 33 and 40, through 41. Henry Wallace was his third one, and then Truman. And Henry Wallace was asked by the New York Times, what is fascism? And as when he was vice president, what is fascism, and who are the American fascists? Are there American fascists that we have to worry about? Now, keep in mind, this was during the war with Germany, the war against fascism. And Henry Wallace in the New York Times, the vice president of the United States, wrote, "The really dangerous American fascists are not those who are hooked up directly or indirectly with the Axis. The FBI has its finger on those. The dangerous American fascist is the man who wants to do in the United States in an American way what Hitler did in Germany in a Prussian way. The American fascist would prefer not to use violence. His method is to poison the channels of public information. With a fascist, the problem is never how to best present the truth to the public, but how best to use the news to deceive the public into giving the fascist and his group more money or more power. If we define an American fascist as one who, in case of conflict, puts money and power ahead of human beings, then there are undoubtedly several million fascists in the United States. There are probably several hundred thousand if we narrow the definition to include only those who, in their search for money and power, are ruthless and deceitful. They are patriotic in times of war because it's in their interest to be so. But in times of peace, they will follow power and the dollar wherever it may lead. Henry Wallace, Vice President of the United States. Are the fascists taking over?
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
Tom Hartman here with you. Henry Wallace, the Vice President of the United States in Franklin Roosevelt's third term, his second Vice President, writing, "Fascism is a worldwide disease. Fascism's greatest threat to the United States will come after the war and will manifest within the United States itself." Sinclair Lewis wrote about this in his 1935 novel, It Can't Happen Here. He was the one to whom was attributed the statement that when fascism comes to the United States, it will come wrapped in a flag and carrying a cross, the statement that Ron Paul made that Tim Russert was trying to take him to task for and meet the press this weekend. Henry Wallace, knowing that several well-known and powerful Americans, including Prescott Bush, had lost businesses in the early 1940s, because of charges by Roosevelt that they were doing business with Hitler, noted in the New York Times. Still another danger is represented by those who pay lip service to democracy and the common welfare. In their insatiable greed for money and power which money gives, do not hesitate surreptitiously to evade the laws designed to safeguard the public from monopolistic extortion. Now you tell me a 17-year-old dying for lack of a liver transplant when she's supposedly fully insured is not monopolistic extortion. American fascists of this stamp were clandestinely aligned with their German counterparts before the war and are now, even now, preparing to resume where they left off after the present unpleasantness ceases. He put that quote in, that phrase in quotes. He said, some big businesses are willing to jeopardize the structure of American liberty to gain some temporary advantage. Monopolists who fear competition and who distrust democracy because it stands for equal opportunity would like to secure their position against small and energetic enterprising companies. In an effort to eliminate the possibility of any rival growing up, some monopolists would sacrifice democracy itself. And then Ron Paul, this weekend on Meet the Press, talking about the same issue.
I think this country, a movement in the last 100 years, is moving toward fascism. Fascism today, the softer term, because people have different definitions of fascism, is corporatism, where the military industrial complex runs the show. When they, in the name of security, pass the Patriot Act, you don't vote for it. You know, you're not patriotic America. If you don't support the troops, if you don't support the war, you don't support the troops. It's that kind of antagonism. But we have more corporatism and more abuse of our civil liberties, more loss of our privacy, national ID cards, all this stuff to coming has a fascist tone to it. And the country's moving in that direction. That's what I'm thinking about. This was not personalized. I never even used my opponent's names, if you notice.
So you think we're close to fascism?
I think we're approaching it very close.
I think we're approaching it very close. And I agree. And this is, you know, here's Ron Paul. I mean, he's on the right playing the role that Dennis Kucinich is playing on the left, which is the archetypal story of the kid who says the emperor is wearing no clothes, who speaks truth to power, And Ron Paul, speaking truth to power. Now, you know, he doesn't always, as I said, there. I don't think that we should do away with Social Security. I don't think we should do away with Medicare. I don't think we should do away with federal aid to education. There's a lot of areas where Ron Paul and I part company. Ron Paul is by and large, a libertarian, conservative Republican. And he does not believe that the welfare clause of the Constitution really means welfare. I do. I mean, that's a profound difference. But we're both American patriots. This is one of those areas where I think, frankly, the right and the left in the United States need to be coming together and saying, you know, this republic is under siege. This constitutionally limited representative democratic republic is under attack. And we're under attack from within. We're under attack from the Ken Lays of the world. We're under attack from the George Bushes of the world. We're under attack, perhaps most importantly, from the Dick Cheneys of the world, the people who go into government. Dick Cheney went into government and helped set up and had Halliburton set up a task force to study whether or not Halliburton could help government, then left government and became the CEO of Halliburton, executed the plan that he had helped set up before when he had been Gerry Ford's chief of staff, came back as vice president and brought Halliburton back in again. When the Iraq War started, Halliburton's stock was trading around 30. A year later, it was trading around 60. I mean, he and his friend, that, in my opinion, is the kind of fascism that we have to be the most concerned about, is the monopolistic fascism, is the setting aside, as Reagan did, of the Sherman Antitrust Act and saying, oh, we don't care how big corporations get. It's setting aside, as Clinton did, the idea that we should use the national trade policy and a national industrial policy to still make things here in the United States. We're going to get into this in some detail in our second hour. What is the economic future of this country? How is this country being hollowed out economically? But in this first hour, I'd like to take your calls after the break here and share with you my thoughts on this as well, on how not only is this an economic issue, but it's also a political issue in as much as it has to do with the loss of liberty. The absolute loss of liberty in the United States and the rise of friendly fascism. 27 minutes past that. Techniques and tools that fascists traditionally use to rise to power is by impoverishing the middle class of their nations. As I said, we'll get into that in some considerable detail in the next hour. It is, frankly, I think at the core of an awful lot of what's going on. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com. Today is Boxing Day, the day after Christmas, the day that in traditional England, people would, or Victorian times and before, I guess, people would put together boxes of stuff around the house they didn't need, and they'd give them to the poor. Of course, because at that time England was pursuing the very kinds of conservative economic policies that the Bush administration wants us to have right now, there were lots of poor to give the boxes to. And we're moving in the same direction. Zeph in Burbank, California. Hey, Zeph, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. I got to tell you, I had Christmas dinner yesterday over at Joe and Nicole's, and we all talked about Tom Hartman's show. After the second glass of wine, we turned to politics, and then it was all about, have you heard the Tom Hartman and all the history that you've been giving us and the middle class and everything, Tom? Has just been great.
Well,
the
thank one you, Zeph. Thing... It's that second glass of wine that concerns me. That's what it takes, huh?
Oh, it was wonderful. Anyway, I called because I have been calling talk shows for the last 20 years trying to educate them on Mussolini's definition of fascism.
Right.
And they do not know what fascism is. I have been hung up on so many times when I tell them what fascism really is.
Yeah.
It's the softer, more economical fascism that we have to fear. And I've coined the phrase right-wing fascist talk show hosts like Limbaugh and Hannity because they support these corporatists. And it's a simple search to find out what fascism means, and you're warning us against it, and I think that's a tremendous threat, and you're doing a great service.
Well, thank you very, very kindly, Zeph, and I appreciate your kind words and your second glass of wine. And here's the problem. The problem with using the word fascism is that during World War II, I mean, you know, there was a lot of anti-fascist rhetoric because there was an axis of fascist countries. There was Spain, Italy, and Germany. And and Spain and Italy, Franco's Spain and Mussolini's Italy, actually were fascist states. In fact, in Italy, Mussolini suspended parliament, did away with it, and replaced it with what was referred to in Italian, as I recall, as the cameo, however you say it in Italian, de fascistio corporationis, the chamber of fascist corporations. In other words, if you lived, well, here where I live in the Portland area, arguably the biggest employer in our area is Nike, you know, Phil Knight and his company Nike. So instead of being represented in Congress by Darlene Hooley and Peter DeFazio and Earl Blumenauer and so forth, David Wu and whatnot, we would be represented by whoever Phil Knight decided to send to Congress on behalf of Nike Corporation. And so the largest corporations in all the areas of Italy had their representatives show up in Parliament and run the country. That's pure fascism. That's what Mussolini did. And that's what Franco did. And the problem is that Hitler didn't quite go that far, although he did call himself, I mean, they did call Hitler a fascist. Hitler really wasn't a fascist. Hitler was a murderous, maniacal, cult-leading, mass-murdering madman. And he gave, frankly, fascism a bad name. So it's tough to talk about fascism because people think you're talking about Hitler, and I'm not talking about Hitler here at all. I'm talking about what Mussolini did, what Franco did, and what is being done now in the United States, what Ron Paul is calling these guys out for over the weekend. Barbara in the Boston area. Hey, Barbara, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. I was just got shot a little bit here, but I I wanted to say that I think one of the biggest problems today is that there are no social studies programs in the schools, that the children are not getting an education in order to be able to know what fascism is or communism or any of these things. It's just a big bad word and not any kind of background.
Yeah, and to the extent that they are, they're being, because of No Child Left Behind, and thank you, Barbara, for your kind comments, they're being asked to memorize, you know, well, what date did Columbus discover America kind of thing. Although I was interested, when I was back in Michigan a couple of weeks ago, my nephew, my brother's son, is in an advanced placement, an AP social studies program, an American government program. And he said that they were studying Federalist Number 10, which is where Madison was arguing against factions, his concern about political parties. And they were going to have a mock constitutional debate and stuff like that. That's kind of cool. So there are some places, some apparently, that, you know, good things are happening. George in Denver, Colorado. Hey, George, what's up?
Hi, Tom. That's an interesting topic. Of course, there are a lot of eerie similarities. And, I mean, you take somebody like Hitler, who deviated from the fascist paradigm, or take somebody like George Bush, who deviates, you know, who goes his own way and starts his unilateral approach to everything.
In what way has George Bush been anti-fascist?
Well, I wouldn't say he's anti-fascist. I'd say what Bush is Bush is all about his own agenda.
Right, but I mean, Hitler ultimately destroyed the fascists within Germany. Hitler went after the corporations who brought him to power. He went after the wealthy people who brought him to power. There were many, for that matter, there were many people who were Jewish in Germany who thought that, you know, they could play nice with him. And I mean, he just ate everybody alive, and ultimately, and even ultimately at the very, you know, in the very last months of the war, he was eating alive his own people. Hitler was nuts. I don't see that in George Bush. I see George Bush right to this very day, and frankly, it's not just Bush. It's the entire Republican Party and a small contingent within the Democratic Party. I see them rewarding the monopolists, rewarding big power, rewarding inherited wealth, and saying, to hell with we the people.
Yeah, but, you know, Bush really isn't doing the corporate structure a lot of good on the world market. In fact,
a lot of
corporates are concerned about the state of the
domestic American corporations are concerned, but if you look at the, I mean, there's a reason why the stock market is still floating around 13,000. I mean, you know, when Clinton came into office, as I recall, it was only around 6,000 or 7,000. I mean, the stock market is up hugely. Why? Because so much of the stock market is made up of multinational corporations. General Electric, for example, which owns NBC and MSNBC, does more than half of their business outside the United States. They don't, you know, at what point do they have to say, well, we're worried about the American economy? I mean, when they're doing more than half their business outside the United States.
Why is Bush so concerned about the dollar?
He wants the dollar to go down.
The
Bush administration has been saying from day one that they want the dollar to go down because they have no trade policy. There are two ways that you can regulate, to the extent that you can regulate it, two ways you can influence or affect the trade relationship that you have with other countries. One is to simply say, if you want to make Levi's outside the United States, we're going to charge a tax when you import them because we think it's important to make Levi's here in the United States. Or perhaps a more appropriate example would be computer chips. The other way is to say we're going to make our dollar more valuable or less valuable. If you make the dollar more valuable, then people are encouraged to export jobs and export manufacturing and import product. If you make the dollar less valuable, if you make the dollar cheaper, then people are encouraged to build factories in the United States and use our labor. And that's actually what's happening. You've got foreign companies now coming into the United States and building factories to use cheap American labor, which is not a good thing, ultimately, because it means that, the profit is being exported, and, B, that we're becoming a third-world country. We're becoming poorer.
But it's also not a good thing that our corporations, that our dollar is falling in value and that we... You know, the American people are suffering for it.
That's right. It's not a good thing for you or me.
A lot of people believe that that's why Bush attacked Iraq, was because Iraq got rid of the dollar, and that has a lot to do with what Bush has against Iran, is that Iran is rid of the dollar, along with Syria and along with Venezuela and many others. And this spells disaster for the United States.
Yeah, it's the smallest piece of the disaster. But I don't disagree with you that there is some concern there. But the Bush administration, you go back to Paulson and Snow's comments. I mean, they've been talking from day one about driving down the dollar. In fact, their big complaint with the Chinese, you know, they're always complaining about the Chinese are manipulating currency. What they're really saying is that the Chinese are keeping their yuan pegged more or less to the dollar. The yuan's only dropped about 13% against the dollar in the last 5 years, 6 years, 7 years since Bush came into office. Whereas the dollar has fallen relative to the euro, the dollar's only fallen relative to the yuan about 13%. It's fallen relative to the euro about 40% since Bush came into power. And so, you know, that makes Chinese imports cheaper. Anyhow, John in Marin County, California. Hey, John. Got about a minute before the break, by the way.
Oh, hi, Tom. I just wanted to add a couple of things to the discussion about Ron Paul. I'm like you. I disagree with a lot of his stuff, but I like listening to him, and I like what he brings to the table. But he's remarkably consistent on this, unusual, that he's against abortion and against a capital punishment.
Right.
Which is kind of unusual, especially for a doctor to be against abortion. He was an OBGYN.
Well, both positions are Catholic. Is he Catholic?
That I don't know.
Those are consistent positions if you're Catholic, or they're consistent positions if you consider abortion to be, you know, the murder of human life or the killing of human life. So,
but also with regard to libertarians, they're against the holding of federal lands, parklands, and they're for divesting of all national parks, forests.
Right. Privatize everything.
Right.
Privatize everything. Turn it all over to the free market.
Huge deal for me. I don't like that.
Yeah, no, I don't like it either. I mean, that's the thing. I see, you know, Ron Paul being a president would be a disaster for the United States. It would take us back to the 19th century, the early part of the 19th century, which is what he says he wants to do. I don't think it would be a good thing for us. But that doesn't mean that in all cases he's not telling the truth. 45 minutes past the hour. What a fine thing it is. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It is Boxing Day, the day after Christmas. Hope you had a great holiday season. Well, actually, it's still ongoing. It's 2 days after the solstice. It is 8 days before the Iowa caucuses. Oh, man, that talk about a zoo. And, of course, we have New Year's Day coming up next week, so... 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Don in Illinois. Hey, Don, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I just had a comment about one time I was in an international business class, and my teacher made the comment about the South Africa AIDS crisis that it'd be better that they didn't receive medicine because they would die faster and it would stop the spread of the disease. And I always thought that was one of the most cruel things I'd ever heard. And then I never had a response until now, and I just had the thought, and I wanted to share it, and that is, if you know you have the disease, you're not going to spread it knowingly. And I think that if they have this, you know, if they don't think they're going to get the drugs, then they'd be less likely to get tested because it's like a death sentence.
Right.
And the only reason I call that is just because it just seems like he was pretty much a libertarian, and the dollars over human life attitude. That same thing with that the insurance company and that lady who died.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Excellent point, Don. And really, what this goes to is the issue of private versus public behavior, and self-sacrifice, in a way. I mean, there was a study that was done back in the 1970s. I'm forgetting the name of the guy who did it, but he won a Nobel Prize either for this work or for similar work, where they asked, and in fact, it may be that I saw that I read this someplace over the weekend. It might have been in one of Paul Krugman's columns or something in the New York Times. But in any case, they asked National Hockey League players back in the 70s, when it was not required to wear protective headgear. They asked them, Do you want to wear protective headgear? The answer was no, because not wearing it gave individual players an advantage. They had better peripheral vision and they could move their head faster. Then they said, do you think that the National Hockey League should require all players to wear protective headgear? The answer was yes. So people were, when asked about isolated individuals, absent of community, when they were asked the question, do you want to have an advantage over others, the answer is yes. But when asked, as part of a community, are you willing to give up advantage if everybody else gives up advantage in exchange for everybody else being a little bit safer? And we're talking advantage here, not liberty, but advantage. Are you willing to give up a small advantage? This is like speed limits. Are you willing to give up a small advantage in order for everybody to be safer? Then the answer was yes. The majority of the people said yes. And that's what the libertarians don't get. They're in the first half of the equation. They think that enlightened self-interest answers all questions. And it's where the conservatives, you know, just go down in flames, frankly. Chad, poor here on Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Chad, what's up?
Hey, how are you?
Just great, but I'll get better, Chad. Thanks for asking. What's up?
Actually, I was just calling to encourage you to post the number for Cigna. I think if your outraged listeners, such as myself and others, heard that number, they might call and complain and say, what kind of a corporation are you? You're supposed to be serving people, and you're putting profits over people. And I think if we held corporations more accountable as consumers, maybe they'd start doing what we want. And
they won't.
You'd have less of this sort of corporate fascism.
Yeah, Chad, I respectfully, they won't. here's the problem. Corporations are required by law to maximize profits. If a corporation does not maximize profit, then the management of that corporation can be held accountable. It's a crime not to maximize profits. And so what Cigna did was a behavior that was going to maximize profits. And frankly, when they decided that they were going to give the liver transplant to the little girl, that was a decision to maximize profits as well, because they were facing bad publicity, and that would have given them good publicity. And so that also would have maximized profits. And so, you know, right along the way, they were doing what a corporation is supposed to do. Our problem in the United States is not that there are companies like Cigna that are making decisions, life and death decisions for us. Our problem is that we have allowed a system to rise up that gives that kind of decision-making power to these corporations. That kind of decision-making power should be in our hands. We collectively. We need to have a national health care system in this country that is not answerable to profit, but is answerable to people.
Oh, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
So it's not Cigna. It's not Cigna. You know, Cigna did a terrible thing. I'll agree with you. But they did the exact same terrible thing that every health insurance company in America is doing. It's not about Cigna being bad. It's about a system that is broken.
Oh, I don't disagree with you on that.
And if enough people call Cigna and complain to them, they're not going to change their policies because that would put them at a disadvantage relative to the other health insurance companies.
Oh, I agree. The second thing to join in with that, yeah, I think we as the people need to hold our government accountable, change the laws and structures for corporations where in cases like this, especially with insurance, you have a case where a person can get the health care they need, that profit is secondary. I mean, granted, I support nonprofit insurance companies. I'm a teacher. Our insurance is nonprofit, and they're absolutely remarkable.
Yeah.
There's never a question.
And that used to be the law in most states.
That
used to be the law in most states. I remember growing up in Michigan, we had Blue Cross Blue Shield, and they were not-for-profit corporations. They were required to be so by the laws of the state of Michigan at that time. And now you've got most of these companies have flipped for-profit. But if you want to call, and thank you, Chad, for the call. If you want to be calling somebody and expressing your outrage over what happened to this little girl, it's not Cigna that you should be calling. It's your elected representatives. And you should be saying, look at how our for-profit health insurance industry is killing people. We need national health insurance. We need a single-payer national health insurance program. And we need it now. We need Medicare for everybody in the United States. Medicare for all. Very simple solution. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman.
Well, it's a mixed bag of news, as they say, but it's really not a mixed bag at all. You're going to be hearing some conflicting things. What, by the way, welcome back to our second hour. You're going to be hearing some conflicting, seemingly conflicting stories, like, gee, the economy is really in trouble, and gee, the economy is really doing great. Gee, the stock market's pretty bad. No, the stock market's pretty good. Home values are down, but homes are being bought up. Manufacturing is down, but no, manufacturing is up. For example, tide is shifting on U.S. exports. This is from today's New York Times, Michael Fletcher writing for the Washington Post, not the New York Times. Challenged by a troubled U.S. economy and the steeply falling dollar, a growing number of U.S. manufacturers are making up for slow domestic sales by expanding them overseas. Now, as I mentioned in the last hour, the reason why this is possible is because the dollar is falling in value. That's no way to have a trade policy. What that means is that anything that you make in the United States might be cheaper overseas someplace, or it might not. And anything that comes into the United States is going to get a little more expensive. Anything. And there are some things that are coming in that you want to say, you know, we'd like to keep that one cheap, or we'd like to make this one particularly expensive. For example, do we want computer chips coming into the United States to always be relatively cheap? Maybe we'd like them to be a little more expensive so that the chip manufacturing companies will have an incentive to manufacture them here in the United States so that we will be able to continue, for example, building a missile, assuming that you need one. Wouldn't it be great if we had a world where we didn't need any? But for the moment, so you can build a missile that has U.S. chips in it rather than Chinese chips in it, China being one of those countries that has threatened to nuke us. So, anyhow, as the dollar declines in value, this is becoming our trade policy. Now, it is fraught with danger. There seems to be a good side to it. For example, this article by Leslie Wines, I'm not sure what the source of it is in terms of wire services and whatnot. It's over at Huffington Post. Oh, it's the Associated Press. Foreign buyers snap up second homes in U.S. And the essence of the story is very simple. It starts out talking about Padden Rota, a woman who is, or perhaps a man, yeah, his primary residence, who's from Kathmandu, Nepal. And what's he doing? Well, he's buying a second home. Where? In Manhattan. He's buying an apartment in New York City. One in five American realtors has sold a home to a foreign investor in the past year, according to the National Association of Realtors, they note in the article. The realty company out of Hamburg, Germany, Engel & Völkers Group, they're opening 300 offices in the United States to sell American properties, not to Americans, but to Europeans. In Boston, they're seeing the largest collection of colleges and universities are in Boston, right? In Boston, they're seeing kids, foreign kids, who are buying condos and apartments because, hey, the amount of the monthly payments, particularly in their currency, is less than the price of rent. And their parents end up with an asset that they think is going to appreciate over time. 7.3% of all the houses sold in Florida in the last year to foreign buyers. So what's happening is America is, as the dollar crashes, America goes on fire sale. America becomes cheaper. Our real estate becomes cheaper to the rest of the world. Our manufacturing facilities become cheaper to the rest of the world. Our businesses, it's not just our products. This is why you have to have a trade policy, an industrial policy that says products going in, products going out, we're going to have tariffs on these products that's going to determine what products we want to make in this country and what products we're willing to allow to be made in other countries. Not to allow, you can't stop anybody from making a product overseas, but what products we want to encourage or discourage the importation and sale of or the exportation and sale of in the United States. So, I mean, it was pretty straightforward stuff. This, a quarter century ago, this, for example, just consider this. This is an article by Paul Craig Roberts, who's been on this program a number of times. A quarter century ago, U.S. oil imports accounted for a quarter of the U.S. trade deficit. Now, that was a quarter century. That was, you know, when Reagan came into office. Now, we're importing even more oil. But it no longer accounts for a quarter of our trade deficit. Now it's only to quote Paul Craig Roberts, a small part. It's less than 10%. Today, oil imports comprise a small part of the U.S. trade deficit. The United States has become 3 to 4 times more dependent on foreign-made manufacturers. America's trade deficit in manufactured goods, including advanced technology products, dwarfs the U.S. energy deficit. In fact, our trade deficit with China for stuff is worse, is bigger than our trade deficit with OPEC for oil. Our U.S. deficit just with Japan is about the same size as our U.S. deficit with OPEC. And really what we're looking at here is not really the importation of goods. What we're looking at is the exportation of labor, because these are the things that historically were made in the United States. So what we're doing is we're hollowing out the United States economy. And as a way of trying to kind of balance that, these guys are pursuing these policies that were first suggested by Milton Friedman back in the 1940s at the Chicago School of Economics, and then later championed by Thomas Friedman in his book The Olive Tree and the Lexus and his new book The Earth is Flat, by replacing essentially trade policies with monetary policies. Controlling the value of the dollar is a way of trying to determine what gets shipped into and what goes out of the United States. The problem is it's universal. It doesn't specify particular industries. There's no way to say this is in the best interest of the United States or this is in the worst interest of the United States. It all, however, is in the best interest of multinational corporations and investors, the hyper-rich, who invest in a multinational world, in a transnational world, who can move their money from one currency to another, you know, in a few seconds. And which leads to this problem. The insane deregulation of our banking and our mortgage industries. And this really truly was insane. Back in 2003, late 2002, early 2003, when the Bush administration announced the final cut. Right, the initial deregulation mania started at the end of the Carter administration, really picked up steam during the Reagan administration in the early 1980s, and continued right through 2003 when the Bush administration actually held a press conference where the guys who were supposed to be regulating the mortgage industry, showed up with a chainsaw and hedge trimmers to say they were cutting red tape. And this led to an explosion of small companies that were basically just front-ending mortgages, just selling, they were like travel agents are to airlines, only far more pernicious, because at least travel agents with airlines are working in a relatively transparent environment. And these guys would come up with these products that they would package, these adjustable rate mortgages and interest-only mortgages and ninja mortgages, no income, no job. So now, as a consequence of this meltdown in the subprime mortgage. You know, these all got sold into the market as investments, and everybody's all freaked out about it now. Central banks are trying to throw money into it. And over in the Telegraph, today's Telegraph, the British newspaper, the headline. Today's one of the three major newspapers in Great Britain. The headline, crisis make may make 1929 look like a walk in the park. Anna Schwartz, the doyen of U.S. monetarism, lifelong student of, of Milton Friedman. As I said, in my opinion, these are the people who started this thing. She says, liquidity doesn't have anything to do with this situation. Anything to do in this situation. It cannot deal with the underlying fear that a lot of firms are going bankrupt. The banks and the hedge funds have not fully acknowledged who's in trouble. That's the critical issue, she says. In other words, it's the fear of bankruptcy that's going to drive us into a depression. Lenders, and then the article here from the Telegraph. Lenders are hoarding the cash, shunning their peers, shunning other banks, as if they were all subprime lenders. York professor Peter Spencer's chief economist for the Item Club says the global authorities have just weeks to get this right or trigger disaster. Quote, the central banks are rapidly losing control. By not cutting interest rates nearly fast enough or far enough, they're allowing the money markets to dictate policy. We are long past worrying about moral hazard, he says. They still have another couple of months before this starts imploding. Things are very unstable and can move incredibly fast. I don't think the central banks are going to make a major policy error, but if they do, this could make the 1929 era look like a walk in the park. And the reserve, the head of the New York Reserve Bank, the Federal Reserve Bank, Tim Geithner, echoed these words, warning of, quote, an adverse self-reinforcing dynamic. That's banker speak for downward spiral. I would suggest that we are already in it. Unpaid credit card debt in the United States. Exploding. I'll give you the statistics right after this break. What this means, how this came about, and how we can get out of this. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and it's getting awful strange out there.
Maybe.
Maybe Santa's crazy.
Maybe we're crazy.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you who's crazy is the cons who brought us this. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporting that Santa's American suit makers are the latest casualty of so-called free trade. Quoting from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, quote, it's not just the toy-making elves who have seen their jobs offshore. Santa's new tailors are in China, too. The last Santa suit manufacturer in the country, in the United States of America, was Halco. They were based in Belle Vernon, Pennsylvania. Specialized in Santa suits, dresses for Mrs. Claus, and outfits for elves. This year, the last locally produced Santa suit was finished in May, and the workers were laid off. Santa suits were one of the last sectors of the apparel industry to be left in the United States. Shoes that had been made in New England were made overseas decades ago, though there were a handful of manufacturers still left in the United States. Textiles, which early in the last century were made both in New England and the South, are no longer made in this country. Glass and electronics, things like ornaments and whatnot, are two other industries that have moved overseas, shifting jobs from the U.S. to India and Asia. Now, in the meantime, what comes along instead? Credit card debt. And we're seeing the housing, as the value of homes goes down, as people can no longer afford to refinance their house, as people can no longer borrow from their house by refinancing, if they can't use their home as ATMs, what are they doing? They're turning to their credit cards. And what's the consequence of this? The Associated Press reports, this from thetrumpet.com, the Associated Press reports that 90-day delinquencies in credit cards represent the worst percentage jump, with major lenders saying that the value of overdue accounts has increased by 50% or more. From October 2006 to October 2007, the value of credit card accounts that were at least 30 days overdue shot up 26%. more than $17 billion. Defaults jumped 18% just in the last year. What we're seeing is an explosion now. You know, it's the other shoe dropping, as they say. People can't borrow against their home anymore. What are they going to do? They're going to borrow against their credit card. And when they run out of things to borrow against, what are they going to do? They're going to stop buying. And when they stop buying altogether, what's going to happen? Thud. This is, I mean, essentially this is what happened in 1929, 1930. People didn't have money. They stopped buying. They stopped buying. Companies started laying people off because they weren't making things anymore because nobody was buying them. They laid people off. People became unemployed. They became unemployed. They didn't have the money to buy things. They didn't have the money to buy things. And so they didn't buy things. And so, you know, they didn't go to restaurants. They didn't have the money to eat out. So the people at the restaurant got laid off. More people who don't have more money to buy things. And this is, to quote New York's Federal Reserve Chief Tim Geithner, an adverse self-reinforcing dynamic. Right. So as a nation, what are we doing about this? Well, what we have been doing as individuals is we've been following the lead of Ronald Reagan and both George Bushes, living high on the hog on debt. This is what both of these guys have been doing. They've been borrowing money and spending money, and we're doing the same thing. And as a nation now, as a consequence of this, we're, you know, $1.13 trillion in debt. It's been about 2.5 minutes since I started this rant. We have gone $2.5 million more in debt in that 2.5. We're accumulating debt at the rate of about $1 million a minute. Used to be we borrowed that money from ourselves. We sold savings bonds. The Treasury now is making it even harder for people to buy inflation-adjusted savings bonds, Series I savings bonds. Pretty good investment because the interest rate that they pay goes up when inflation goes up. And inflation is coming, I'm telling you, unless there's a massive deflation. But the government is cutting it down to the point where now you can only buy a maximum of, as I recall, $20,000 worth of these things starting at the first of the year. It used to be over $100,000 that you could buy. Why? Well, they won't say, but the best guess is that they want people to be putting their money with private corporations rather than the government, that this is more part of the Bushies. Let's move it over to Wall Street. If you're going to invest money, we want it to go with, you know, Goldman Sachs. We want it to go with Merrill Lynch. We want it to go with one of the big investment houses rather than with savings bonds. We used to borrow the money from ourselves, savings bonds. We're talking about $30,000 every person in the United States owes to our federal government that has been borrowed in our name, in your name, in my name, in our children's name, every single person from birth to old age, every single person in the United States, $30,000 in debt right now. Our country has gone in our names, $30,000 per person. Now, instead of borrowing it from ourselves, we're borrowing it from other countries. $610 billion held by Japan. $407 billion held by China. $210 billion held by the UK. $123 billion held by oil exporters. $2.23 trillion, up 9% from last year, the U.S. debt is now held outside the United States. And we really don't know the complete list, you know, but this is the best guess, because a lot of it's held in the United States, in funds in the United States that are owned outside the United States. 27 minutes past the hour. No excuse for being who I am. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. So what do we do about it? What's the solution to this? Well, first of all, we're to the point, I mean, I think that we're beyond the October of 1929 point. We're already experiencing not just pain, but agony as a consequence of 26 years of Reaganism. So any solutions actually are probably going to be end up being blamed as part of the cause. Smoot-Hawley, for example, when they saw that global free trade was not working in the 1920s, at least not working to the benefit of the United States, and the crash of 29 happened, the Republican Great Depression began. In 1930, Herbert Hoover, the Republican, was still president. Roosevelt was not elected until 32, the election of 32. He became president in 33. So in 1930, Herbert Hoover was still president, a Republican, and he said, okay, we've got to make more stuff in the United States. And so they passed the Smoot-Hawley laws that raised the trade tariffs slightly. They raised them, you know, a couple percentage points up to an average of around 30%. They were in the high 20s before that, the mid to high 20s. They raised them up to 30%. And to this day, you've got cons who are gung-ho for free trade saying, oh, it was Smoot-Hawley that caused the Great Depression. No. Smoot-Hawley was an early effort by, and actually one that probably did a lot of good in some ways by Herbert Hoover, the Republican, to bring manufacturing back to the United States or keep it as much here as possible. But so number one, we should kill all the free trade deals. And I guarantee you, 50 years from now, the conservatives will be going, oh, yeah, that caused the Great Recession or the Great Depression of 2008 or 2009. Well, no, it will have softened it. But we need to do away with these insane free trade deals. Number one. Number two, we need to re-regulate the banks, the mortgage companies, and the credit card industries. Re-regulate them. So you actually have to have good credit to get a credit card. Number three, we need to fix our bankruptcy laws. We need to go back and say to all the guys, to all these, Joe Biden and all these guys who pushed through these, this incredibly corrupt change in the bankruptcy legislation that made it harder for average people to declare bankruptcy, but just fine for Donald Trump, thank you very much. Need to say, sorry, our bankruptcy laws are here to protect people. The majority, more than half of all Americans who declare bankruptcy, family bankruptcy, are doing so because of medical bills. Half of them are insured. Another third of all the people who declare bankruptcy are single women who were not single before they were bankrupt. They became, as a consequence of a divorce, they lost a big chunk of their income they couldn't afford. So change our bankruptcy laws. And number four, and finally, perhaps most important, bust up the monopolies, particularly the media monopolies. Here's a great example of this. USA Today, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, fair.org. You could read this over at their website. And a good example of corporate media striving to narrow down the Democratic primary field, USA Today had a story on candidates' electability that basically only talked about Obama, Barack Obama, and Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. That's it. They, missing from the, from USA Today's polling about electability was John Edwards, even though aside from Clinton and Obama, Edwards is the only Democratic candidate who consistently polls in double digits. Like other establishment media outlets, this is from the Fair News release, however, USA Today seems to have difficulty providing a level playing field to a candidate who consistently attacks corporate interests, otherwise known as the media's owner and sponsors. An exercise in post-debate fact-checking by USA Today, this back from December 14th, for example, took issue with this statement by Edwards. Edwards said, quote, one of the reasons that we've lost jobs and we're having trouble creating jobs is because corporate power and greed have literally taken over the government, end quote. David Jackson and Frederica Schouten wrote for the newspaper USA Today their reality, quote, Edwards is wrong about job creation. There were 94,000 new jobs created in November, according to Bureau of Labor Statistics. Apparently, USA Today doesn't realize that you have to create 150,000 new jobs every month just to keep up with the growth in population. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mark, in, Lamy, New Mexico?
I'm calling from Lamy, New Mexico.
Lamy. Hey, yes. Mark, what's up?
Well, Happy New Year to you and all of your listeners.
Well, thank you.
I hope it will be a happy one.
Thank you, and the same to you, Mark, and happy Boxing Day. Perhaps we should create we should go back to the, you know, everybody should be boxing up the stuff they got for Christmas that they don't want and taking it to Goodwill or Salvation Army.
Passing it on to somebody new.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I agree with everything you say, as usual, but I'm wondering if maybe, since the average American citizen has abdicated his citizenly duties, perhaps we'd be better off selling the country to savvy Japanese and German investors instead of waiting until the final collapse and selling ourselves to the Emir of Abu Dhabi and the House of Saud.
It's already done. Sound recording industries in the United States, 97% foreign-owned. Commodity contracts, dealing and brokerages, 79% foreign-owned. Motion picture and sound recording industries, 75% foreign-owned. All the metal ore mining in the United States, all the mines in the United States, 65% foreign-owned. All the wineries and distilleries, 64% foreign-owned. All the publishing companies in America, book publishing, magazine publishing, directory, database, 63% foreign-owned. Even our cement industries. You say, oh, let's rebuild New Orleans with American cement, 62% foreign-owned. 57% of all of our engines, turbines, and power transmission equipment, foreign-owned. This is the stuff that we're still making in the United States. The companies that make it are foreign-owned. And it goes on. I mean, the list goes on and on. But I would say that I'd like to challenge, Mark, your assertion that we have given up on our democratic responsibilities. Bill Clinton ran as a progressive. Now, granted, he said he was going to do NAFTA and GATT, but the majority of Americans were opposed to that. But by and large, he ran as a progressive. He just didn't govern as one. And I think that the American people have been presented with bad choices. They've been given bad information by the media. And in many cases, they actually have voted for people that they thought were progressive. And the problem is that we have politicians who have not been consistent and haven't told us the truth. Mark, thanks for your call. Rama in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening on KTRC. Hey, Rama.
Hey there, Tom. Merry Christmas.
Well, thank you. I think we're a day late. Happy Boxing Day for you.
Yes, happy Boxing Day. I was going to bring up the fact that you were talking about the debt, and did you know about the Leo Wanta story and worldreports.org, $27.5 trillion.
No, I don't. But I will check it out, Ron. Worldreports.com will check it out. Ron in Montreal, Canada. Hey, Ron.
Yeah, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can.
I just wanted to rectify something you were saying.
Sure.
I'm calling from Montreal, and you were talking about the Smoot-Hawley Act.
Smoot-Hawley.
The Smoot-Hawley, raising the. The problem with that look at it takes a very insider look that America is the only country in the world. The rest of the countries, the trading countries, did the exact same thing. They upped their tariffs.
Yeah.
What happened was that worldwide trading slowed to a trickle of what it had been previously, and that's what really aggravated the
if you go back, that's you're reciting conventional wisdom, Ron. If you go back and you look at the actual case, you'll see that the worldwide trade
exactly what.
Worldwide trade had slowed to a trickle before Smoot-Hawley. Worldwide trade slowed to a trickle as a result of a worldwide Great Depression.
Yeah, well, what happened, why was there such a low trade before the Smoot-Hawley Act?
Because the world was in a depression.
Yeah. Well,
because there was a liquidity crisis, because companies couldn't borrow, people the value of real estate was collapsing, and many people actually trace this back to a real estate bubble in Florida, of all things. There was a huge speculative real estate bubble in the United States. There were several of them. The largest was going on in Florida and throughout the mid-20s, the 1920s, and it burst in 1927 in Florida.
Bottom line is that the Smoot-Hawley Act did nothing to improve trade or to improve manufacturing in America.
I would agree with you that it did nothing to improve trade. In fact, Smoot-Hawley slightly reduced the amount of worldwide trade.
Exactly.
I would argue, however, that reducing worldwide trade is not necessarily a bad thing. If Canada's making more stuff for Canadians and more Canadians have jobs, and if Americans are making more stuff for Americans and more Americans have jobs, making stuff for themselves, what's wrong with that?
Well, anyway, the only thing that took anybody out of the Depression was World War II.
No, that's not true. In fact, World War II slowed down the speed with which we would have come out of the Depression, because an enormous amount of the resources that Franklin Roosevelt was putting into rebuilding America had to be stopped and be put into building bombs and missiles bombs and airplanes and tanks and things and bullets that got wasted in World War II. I mean, they were destroyed and they didn't. So, you know, if he put $100 million into building bridges and schools and hospitals, that was stuff that produced.
What was the employment rate in 1943 compared to 1938?
Well, obviously, we were coming out of the Great Depression, number one. And number two, yes, war does create a temporary boom in hiring. Yeah, absolutely. You know, because we went into a wartime economy. We had to borrow a massive amount of money to do it. That's not what brought us out of the Great Depression, though. That's what caused the early 1950s to be such a slow period, because we took all that money that should have been put into things that will produce a return on investment, things like schools and bridges and roads, dams and electrical systems and telephone systems, and we put that money into bombs and dropped them on Germany and Japan. And so as a consequence of that, in the early 1950s, there was a lot of productive capacity that would have existed if the same amount of money had been used by Roosevelt to continue the programs of the New Deal, but instead had to be stopped to fight World War II. Go back and look at the history of it, Ron. The conservative talking point is that World War II got us out of the Great Depression. It ain't true. World War II certainly produced a short-term fiscal stimulus. War always does. Just like the Vietnam War made things look good during the Nixon and Johnson administrations. And then whacked Jimmy Carter when the war was over because the bill became due. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Because you're mine, I walk the line. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Yeah, we all need to be walking the line for democracy. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Sherry in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Sherry, what's up?
Oh, okay. I just wanted to say that Barack Obama voted for the bankruptcy bill, and I think he's kind of leery sometimes on the way he votes.
Well, hang on just a second here. I'm looking. I've got the roll call. We're talking about Senate Bill number 256. This is, Senate Bill 256, March 10th, 2005. The roll call vote, Obama voted no.
He voted for it.
No, Hillary Clinton did not vote. Obama voted no.
And, for the bankruptcy bill?
Right, and Biden voted yes. Yeah, that's what I'm seeing.
I've always been really sure that he voted for it.
Yeah, well, maybe I am looking at a vote for cloture or something like that.
Yeah, so I'll bet you are.
I'll have to find out. But in any case, I'm not, Sherry, thank you for your call. I'm not willing to indict somebody for one particular vote. We have a corrupted system. I would suggest to you that anybody who voted for this bankruptcy bill did so, and I know several, a couple of the senators in the Pacific Northwest here did as well, tragically, did so because they're getting money from that industry. I mean, let's just, call it what it is. Bribery is legal in the United States. It's called campaign contributions, and it's not a good thing. We need to do away with it. We need to go back to 1907, Teddy Roosevelt saying, hey, it's a felony for corporate money to be going to politicians, period. Dick in Seattle. Hey, Dick.
Yeah, Tom, I don't think we can win this this neo-fascistic economic class war at the water cooler until we cut off the fuel of propaganda that's been feeding it from the corporate media all these years. And it's the big money establishment media that holds this high ground. And I think that has to be our principal target if we really want to take back our democracy. Because
well, and that's my point, Dick, is break up the monopolies. And it's not just the media. I think right across the board, if you start breaking up monopolies, you break up the hospital monopolies, break up the pharma monopolies, break up the media monopolies, break up the publishing monopolies, break up the manufacturing monopolies, and the telco monopolies, the cable monopolies, the power monopolies. And what you'll find is that, prices might go up a little bit, although breaking up AT&T actually increased shareholder value and led to a decrease in the cost of telecommunications. You recall. And that was a breakup that was pushed not by progressive politicians, but by a corporation, MCI. They're the ones who sued. But nonetheless, let's say that the worst happens and, you've got smaller local companies and they're producing a product that's costing a little more locally. Yes, but they're also having they're paying more locally. They're responsible to their local communities. I mean, it would be a good thing, frankly, in my mind. Dave in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Dave.
Yeah, I was listening to the radio last week, and I don't think it was your show, but it was the same station. But anyway, they were talking about the difference in the percentage of revenue that corporate taxes provided for this government.
Right.
And if I remember correctly, and I probably don't, it seemed like prior to Reagan being elected, the corporate taxes accounted for somewhere around 50% of the revenue for the country.
Yeah, it was during the Eisenhower presidency, it approached 50%. It was in the 40s. It was when Reagan was elected, it was in the 30s. It's now down to about 7%.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's why, and that's why back, you know, back 30, 40, 50 years ago, the middle class did not pay anything close to the percentage of income taxes that they're paying now, because corporations were paying their fair share of the cost of the commons. And now the cost of the commons is falling entirely on the shoulders of the middle class, people like you and me. And the consequence of that is that, the middle class is buying into the right-wing talking points of, oh, my God, we're overtaxed, because, in fact, they are. And the corporations are getting away with murder. And we're paying for the commons that they're using. We're paying for the roads they use. We're paying for the educated workforce that they use. We're paying for, you know, clean water and sewage and septic. We're paying for the civil infrastructure, for the court system, for the jails, right across the board. We're paying for the whole thing, and the corporations are making out like bandits. And one of the major ways that they're doing it is by playing municipalities and states and counties off against each other. It's like when Boeing decided to change their headquarters. Who's going to give us the biggest tax break? Who's going to give us the best deal? And it's just, I think it's just wrong. I think, you know, I agree with Bernie Sanders that we should say, okay, no more federal highway funds or some kind of major federal funding. No more goes to any state, municipality, or county that allows a corporation to play them off against others. Vicki in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Vicki.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to say that Obama did not get the bankruptcy bill. I know that.
Okay, so yeah, okay, great. Thank you very much. So the thing that I have here is apparently correct of, you know, who voted for what. Yeah, and Louise just confirmed that. She said Obama did not vote for the bankruptcy bill. Let's see here, HMU. Yeah, no, the votes against included Murray from Washington, Obama from Illinois, Lieberman from Connecticut. Uh-oh. Anyhow, 866-303-2270, Virginia in Portland. Hey, Virginia.
Hey, Tom, I wanted to give you a slightly different twist on this. A few years ago, I saw a hedge fund manager on Charlie Rose, and he was explaining to Charlie that because of the Bush tax cuts, there was way more capital out there in the market than there were good investment places for it. And I think that's part of what put this mortgage thing on steroids. It already existed, but I think a lot of that money went there.
It arguably might have been in small measure as a consequence of the Bush tax cuts, but I would say that the real thing that drove it was the fact that Greenspan drove interest rates down to the point where they were minus two.
Yeah.
In other words, you could make a 2% profit during the Greenspan era simply by borrowing money, sitting on it for a year, and then repaying it as, you know, having the value of the money versus inflation.
Yeah, but let me continue. I saw Chalmers Johnson doing an interview, a presentation on C-SPAN a few months ago on his Sorrow of Empire trilogy.
Right.
And he said near the end of this conversation that there were three possible ways to stop America from continuing to do what it was doing globally, which is, I think we'll all agree, a really pretty awful thing. And the only one of which he saw as possibly actually happening being bankruptcy.
And that's what we're facing. 57 minutes past the hour.
Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program. The Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Alex Frankel is on the line with us. His quest to explore corporate culture on the front lines led him to go undercover. They had hired, trained, and dressed in uniform in some of America's best-known retailers. His new book, Punching In, The Unauthorized Adventures of a Frontline Employee. Hey, Alex, welcome to the program.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you?
Just great. You went undercover doing what, you know, a lot of Americans are simply doing to survive. What brought this about?
Well, as a journalist writing about business and things of that nature, I was more and more interested in finding out how companies that use people on their front lines kind of build a loyalty there so that the people can represent the company and be the face of the company to the public.
And how do they do that?
Well, the only way I knew how to find out was to start applying and getting the jobs. And then I started working at places like UPS, Starbucks, and Gap. And what I found is that, each company has a distinct corporate culture that ideally the people will buy into.
Mm-hmm. For example?
Well, a place like Starbucks, you know, it's a company that's about 30 years old with about 12,000 stores. And if you walk into a Starbucks in Chicago and one in San Francisco, you'll have a pretty similar experience. And that's all based on these tenets of a corporate culture that start, you know, well deep within the company and come out in the stores themselves. And as a new employee, you'll do things like read manuals and watch DVDs that will all reinforce the part of this corporate culture.
Now, I remember 2 years ago or so, I started doing I'm the co-host for the third hour of a local radio show here in Portland. And for 2 years, up until March or April or May of this year, I did the entire 2 hour or the entire 3 hours. So I did 6 hours of radio. And during that time, I remember we had on some folks who were running some local coffee shops, and I took a swipe at Starbucks. You know, I just made some gratuitous comment about them, and several Starbucks employees called. And I was really surprised by that. Frankly, the number of people who called who worked for Starbucks defending the company, saying, "Hey, you know, at least we're getting health insurance, or we're getting decent benefits here. We, you know, we're treated well, we're paid well." Is that inconsistent with what you experienced?
Well, at Starbucks, you know, there's plenty of arguments to be made about the homogenizing effect of so many stores and so many neighborhoods. But as far as how the company treats the employees, it definitely ranks high up there in terms of, you know, like you mentioned, offering health insurance. And there is a high amount of loyalty, so that if somebody works in one Starbucks location and moves to another city, they'll often stick with the company. And that turnover, keeping that turnover low, is the goal for any company that uses service workers on the front lines. And Starbucks is definitely, you know, ahead of the game there.
If keeping turnover low is so important, then why would you have Walmart versus Costco, for example? Costco pays their people well. They pay their people union wages. They have good benefits. At least this is my understanding. Walmart, by and large, doesn't. And they both sell cheap stuff at huge discounts. Why would Walmart put themselves at a competitive disadvantage by paying people poorly?
Well, each company, you know, looks at the equation of customer service and payment of employees differently. And I was looking mostly at companies that were paying even a few more dollars an hour than Walmart or Costco. And so they're attracting a certain type of employee. But, you know, Walmart's, their approach is to see how many people they can hire for the lowest wages. And, you know, that's their, the way they do it. But it's, you know, and the experience you have there is results.
Right. So, Alex Frankel, the author of Punching In, the Authorized Adventures of a Frontline Employee, what's the conclusion that you brought out of all this stuff? I mean,
well, there's a couple, but the main thing was that, you know, at the places I wanted to work were really known for great customer service and strong cultures. And what I found was that even though I might have gone and worked at five different companies over a two-year period, I didn't necessarily match all of the places I worked as an employee. And what I found was the best companies really know who they're looking for in terms of hiring, and then they attract those people, they hire them, and they get the most people that can match their corporate culture and mission. And then the customer sees that as a benefit when they get good customer service. And, you know, a poorer example is a company that doesn't really know who they're looking for, just hires and attracts anyone, and then doesn't necessarily find people who want to stick around and offer great service.
Right. So the companies that are, so basically there's some companies that are doing it well and some that are doing it poorly.
Indeed. And you know, I myself is a sort of a test case working through these different retailers. I found a place like UPS suited me much more than a place like Starbucks or The Gap.
You as a person.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, Alex, thanks a lot for dropping in.
Oh, you bet.
And talking to us. Alex Frankel, his book is Punching In, The Unauthorized Adventures of a Frontline Employee by Alex Frankel. Ken in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I want to go back to World War II. I thought a couple
sure.
of, on one of your shows, we were talking about the GI Bill.
Yeah.
The fact that the GI Bill for World War II, they came back and got a bunch of money, and they actually moved into the cities, which would generate, you know, build more stuff, and went to school, started families. And I thought the conclusion was kind of that is what really got us out of the Depression.
Well, it was one of the things that really stimulated the U.S. economy. The main thing that the GI Bill did is it provided for education for Americans. I mean, I'm not remembering who the guest was at the time that we had on the program, but was talking about how the GI Bill was actually put into place as a way of preventing riots, that they were concerned that there were going to be all these people coming back from the war who are now civilians, and there weren't enough jobs for them, so they had to figure out something to do to get them off the streets. And so the thing to do was let them go to college for free. And that provided a buffer period, a 4, 5, 6 year period while these people were in college, during which the economy could grow enough to meet the demand that, or to create the jobs, you know, that would meet the demand for labor and thus not end up with a bunch of, you know, unemployed GIs on the streets and that kind of thing. So that's my recollection of it, Ken. Terry in Spring Valley, California. Hey, Terry.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling today about the discussion about the similarities between 1929 and now. There's a similar planetary pattern that has me a little concerned as an astrologer. Mars is retrograde or in apparent backward motion right now in Cancer, and it's an identical pattern to its retrograde in 1928 preceding the 1929 crash. During that time in 1928, the stock exchange was closed after the heaviest trading day on record, which was November 23rd. And after peak trading days on the 12th and 16th, and then on December 8th, the stock prices tumbled sharply in the face of the heaviest selling volume ever. Now, it sounds like Hoover did a little bit of a better response to the prevailing issues than Bush has done or is going to do. And with the patterns now being, I think, worse than they were in 1929, I think you're right. It really does have me concerned.
Yeah, although one thing that Hoover didn't do or wasn't able to do, one thing that the Fed didn't do is the Fed didn't try to increase liquidity early on. In other words, pump more money into the marketplace. And many suggest that the crash of 29 wouldn't have turned into the Great Depression if there had been an infusion of liquidity. I mean, that's the theory that the kind of Milton Friedman monetarist theory. And that's one of the reasons why Bernanke and why the European Central Bank, the ECB, and why for that matter the British Central Bank have just in all cases loaned a whole bunch of money at low interest rates into the banking system to try to increase the amount of money floating around. The problem that they're having, and it's a very interesting astrological perspective, Terry, thank you very much. The problem that they're having is that all of this money is in the system now and it's floating around, but the banks are more likely to hold on to it. And like, you know, digging in their heels against hard times rather than loaning it to other banks or loaning it to businesses. They're not behaving like it's real liquidity. And that's a tough one. Paul in Colorado. Hey, Paul. Got about a minute before the break. What's up?
Oh, hi.
You're on the air.
Happy New Year. I have two questions for you to comment on. I'll just state them and get off the air. I've heard you talk about Henry Ford raising wages to $5 a day. And I was curious if that is in consilience with neoclassical economic theory. I don't think
he did. It was not Henry Ford's idea. It was his business partner's idea and his wife's idea. And it was essentially forced on him, and then he took credit for it.
Yeah, because I would be curious if you could post some sort of quick summary of that, because I never see it in the textbooks. And it ties into the GI Bill and something that created a middle class, which I don't think neoclassical economics does. So I would like a summary of that.
Yeah, well, just like the GI Bill wasn't there just, you know, out of benevolence. It was there to prevent riots. You know, Henry Ford raised wages because his business partner was threatening him. And his business partner went on to become a very progressive senator in Michigan, a state senator. 16 minutes past the hour. It's a Tom Hartman program.
Tom Hartman Program, the true people's radio.
Tom Hartman.
I know this evening now deals a surprise. I know that you have, cause there's magic in my eyes. I can see for miles and miles and miles.
It is illogical. Put a cap on VA funding when it's impossible to put a cap on the number of those wounded and injured in service to their country. The slogan up at the top of VAWatchdog.org, keeping an eye on the VA, because somebody has to. Larry Scott, the editor-in-chief, chief cook and bottle publisher of VAWatchdog.org, on the line with us. Hey, Larry.
don't care how you pronounce it. I hope you had a good Christmas, Tom.
I had a wonderful Christmas, Larry. Thank you, and I hope the same for you.
I did. I absolutely did. Hey, if I could just take a second, I notice your listeners have been referring back to the GI Bill, the conversation we had a couple of weeks ago. If they want to read one of the best books ever written about the GI Bill, the biggest social program this country ever had, a program that returned to our economy more than $7 for every dollar invested. Edward Humes is the author, H-U-M-E-S, and the book is called Over Here, How the GI Bill Transformed the American Dream. It reads like a novel. It is a fascinating book. All you have to do is go to Powell's or Amazon and type in GI Bill, and you'll find the book.
Are you the person who was telling me that the GI Bill was put into place to prevent riots in the streets?
Yeah, we talked about that a couple weeks ago. It started off as a fear and then turned into this marvelous social program that, as I just mentioned, returned over $7 to our economy for every one of the billions and billions of dollars spent. It was just a marvelous program, and you can read about it in Over Here.
Right, and that would be the exact reverse of what happened with the military spending that preceded the GI Bill. You know, for every dollar that went into building a tank or a bomb or a bullet, probably only 20 cents or 10 cents or something like that ended up back in the economy because the majority of the value got dropped on Germany or Japan and gone.
And like a lot of the dollars we're spending military spending today.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot
that's
of
the
that
problem.
Is going to
that's
private
the problem
contractors who are now offshores.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's that too. I mean, that's the problem of military spending. Anyhow, I just see a whole big stack of stories over at VAWatchdog.org. Let me let you filter them. What's the list probably
the most interesting thing here since we spoke last is we do have a new VA secretary. Dr. James Peek is our VA secretary. He's a former Army Surgeon General. And I'm very disappointed in this move. He was passed unanimously. His name was passed up to the full Senate unanimously by the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. We didn't hear one hard question to this man. We didn't hear one word of, hey, who are you really and what are you going to do here? We didn't hear from Senator Bernie Sanders or Senator Patty Murray or Senator Barack Obama. They gave this guy a pass. His name went up to the Senate, passed by unanimous consent, and he was sworn in last week. It's very disappointing because both he and President Bush at the swearing-in ceremony, by the way, the actual oath was given by Vice President Cheney, so all of the dignitaries were there. But they plan to go forward with the Dole-Shalala Commission agenda. This is the Senator Bob Dole, Secretary Donna Shalala Commission that is literally going to rewrite the way veterans get benefits.
Is that it largely privatizes the VA.
It does in many ways. First of all, it gives new veterans of one conflict, preference over another. It gives them special and extra benefits that have never been done. That's just like saying, okay, you served in Bosnia, you get more money.
Then if you served in Vietnam.
Right. It gives them different levels of benefits, and it also, the bad part here, now that might sound good to some, but it has a means test every 3 years tossed in where the finances of the person and various other things are analyzed, and these benefits can then be pulled. So what we're looking at is if this is pushed through, and it can't be done unilaterally, Congress will have to help here, but if this gets pushed through, the next step would be to apply this to older veterans who could end up, if the same rules are applied, having benefits reduced or benefits lost. So this is something that we're really going to have to keep an eye on during the next year, at least, that Dr. Peek is VA secretary.
Well, means testing essentially turns a program, I mean, this is why they want to means test Social Security. It essentially turns a program from an entitlement, something that you earned as a consequence of your service, or in the case of Social Security, that you earned as a consequence of paying into the program for years and working. It turns it from an entitlement into a welfare program. And it's politically very easy to cut welfare programs. It's politically very difficult to cut entitlement programs. So if you want to do away with an entitlement program, like veterans benefits or Social Security, then the first thing you want to do is convert them from an entitlement into a welfare program that is means tested.
That's exactly right. And you want to package them thusly. And if you'll go back and look at the president's and the vice president's speeches over the last 7 years, you will find them always mentioning veterans benefits in the same sentence as Medicaid.
Okay, which is a means-tested program. It's a program for the poor.
That's exactly right, and they try to conflate the two and make people believe that VA benefits are welfare, but they're not. Moving on to another topic here.
We've got about 30 seconds here.
Presidential candidates coming up. We've got voting information on the front. It's a link to votesmart.org, not only how the candidates have voted or how they've spoken on veterans issues, but all the other issues as well. Very easy to follow through set of links. People can do research on their candidates coming into the caucus in the primary season.
Very good. Very, very well done. And votesmart.org is a great site. With
fantastic.
Very, very good research on it.
Without the bit.
Okay. Larry Scott, VAwatchdog.org. Keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to. Larry Scott, thanks so much for dropping by.
And we'll keep doing that, Tom, and thank you.
Thank you. And Happy New Year to you. Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour, number 866-303-2270. Drop into our live chat room. Go over to tomhartman.com or participate in our blog or our message boards there. There's also a blog over at airamerica.com. Stick around. Four minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Welcome back to the program. Happy Boxing Day, the day that we should be boxing up all the stuff that we don't need or don't want and taking it off to a charity. I mean, there's some good ones out there. And this is the history of Boxing Day and something that I think that we should revive. Let's see here. Apparently, in the first hour of my program, I made a comment that somebody, Hal Ginsberg, posted over on our website. He says, Tom, I'd like to voice one possible concern with your broadcast day. You said in the first hour that there are many people who are Jewish in Germany who thought they could play nice with Hitler. Could you please provide the evidence on which you rely for this provocative and revisionist statement? If this is true, it is important and newsworthy even after 60 years. If it is not, then the statement is anti-Semitic and you should issue a retraction. Many thanks. My comment was based on the relatively large number of people that I know who are dear and close friends who live both in Israel and the United States who lost ancestors in the Holocaust. And having lived in Germany and read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Scherer, which I encourage you to read. In the very early days, when Hitler first came to power, I mean, he was quite upfront in Mein Kampf, in his autobiography, about basically blaming everything on the Jews. When he first came to power, there were a lot of people who thought this guy is a cartoon character. And Kristallnacht, I think, dispelled, you know, any belief in that. But in the very, very early days, there were people who did not take him seriously. And that was my point, is that there are people who are looking at what's going on in the United States and not taking it seriously. And we do so at our peril. Although the other point that I was making and the bigger point that I was really trying to make is that to draw up an analogy with Hitler is a terrible mistake, that Hitler was not a fascist. That was the point, that was the context in which I was making it, that he was a homicidal madman cult leader. So, no, I'm not revising history. Thank you very much. Paul in Berkeley, California. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Well, it's about the Montgomery GI Bill.
Yeah.
And I work with counseling GIs and the way that the recruiters are putting this forward, and they're offering college to people and offering them, I think, a max, offering them the $70,000 scholarship or $36,000. But what they don't tell them is that this has to be used within a certain amount of time after they get out of the Army, and that it's amortized over, spread over 4 years. So if it's $36,000 that they get, first of all, the $70,000 is only if they qualify for the Army-Navy scholarship, which many people don't qualify for, depending on their score in the ASVAB, the test that's taken. So what I'm getting at is the way it has to be done over, it's put out over 4 years, which is $9,000 a year. If you go to community college and only go 2 years, you only get half of that. And the way in which it's become...
What's your point, Paul?
Rip-off. Hello?
I'm sorry. I'm getting all this detail here. I'm not sure what the point is.
Well, no, the point that I'm saying is the comments on what the Army, what the Montgomery Bill was like, when people came out of World War II and how it's been whittled down and really is not a benefit for soldiers at this point and the way in which it's being misrepresented.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I agree with you. GI benefits right now suck. They should be a whole awful lot better. And frankly, you know, right across the board, what we're finding is that stuff that frankly should be being done by government and should be being done by us is being done by private corporations, particularly private corporations who are cronies of Dick Cheney. And it's just, it's absolutely wrong. It's absolutely wrong. Paul, thanks for the call. Tim in L.A. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Tom. You know what? I was listening to your show and listening to, like, different, you know, news programs. It seems like America is being destroyed by design, and it seems right to create a North American Union because, you know, the dollar is whittling down. And but my question there then is, if the Bush administration were to create a fascist nation, what good is it if our dollar isn't worth anything when we can't buy anything?
Right. Well, actually, there's an enormous economy here. Even if you wipe out much of the American middle class, there's still money to be made. There's still power to be acquired. I mean, it's not like we're going away. It's not like we're just, you know, a tumbleweed that's blown
right
away or something. I mean, there's still tremendous natural resources in North America. The asset base here is huge. It's a question of redistributing it. It's a question of who's going to end up owning everything. And that's what they're all talking about.
So as Americans, what should we do then? I mean, it sounds like, I don't want to sound pessimistic. I don't want to say it's inevitable, but what can we do?
Well, this is my point. This is my point earlier that I think that what we need to do is a multi-step program, and very simple. Number one, bust up the monopolies, the big corporate monopolies.
Right.
Number two, fix the bankruptcy laws so that people can actually take risks. There's a reason why we have bankruptcy laws, and it's because we want to encourage small business. We want to encourage people to take risks. Henry Ford declared bankruptcy 7 times before he made it. He couldn't do that today. So we want to take our bankruptcy laws back to where they were. We want to re-regulate those industries that tend to be natural monopolies or that have the power to flip our government. Things like the banks, the mortgage companies, and the credit card industry. We want to re-regulate them, and we want to do away with this whole insane notion of global corporate transnational free trade and return to trade policies that are based on an industrial policy that have to do with what's best for the United States and what's best for the people of the United States first, and let every other country in the world say, you know, the same thing for themselves, you know, what's best for our country, and then you get back to David Ricardo's notion of comparative advantage. Comparative
right.
advantage should be done within the borders of the United States. The idea of, you know, what's the best place for me to manufacture, what's the best product, what's the best pay, and all that kind of thing. Not in the context of, okay, I'm going to compare U.S. workers versus Chinese workers. And
right.
those are the simple steps that I would take, Tim. That's where I would go with it. Rebecca in Edmonds, Washington. Hey, Rebecca. Rebecca? No, Rebecca. Okay, Charles in San Francisco, California. Hey, Charles, what's up? No, Charles. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph. Can you hear me?
Tom. Merry Christmas.
Yeah, well, thank you. Happy Boxing Day to you.
I think that's even good, better. Yeah, I... On your point with regard to corporations, I think the biggest political doublespeak these days is that America is a capitalist economy. Because it isn't capitalistic, it's cronyist. Corporations, in terms of return on investment, probably get much more out of investing in a politician for political subsidies than they do in investing in plant and equipment to compete with the Japanese. And we have a tax code that says that it taxes corporations, but you then look at the deductions, the exceptions, the credits, and the other loopholes, and the subsidies, and we end up as the middle class subsidizing those corporations.
Hugely.
Hugely. And I think the, how shall I say?
And it's not just in the United States, by the way, Ralph. It's all over the world. We have a worldwide corporatist economy in large part because these big transnational corporations are playing one country off against the other.
Absolutely, Tom. You see that in small towns with Walmart or the other big retailers. If you don't give them 20 years of free property taxes and various other subsidies, they'll locate next door.
Right, and you will recall Walmart, when Sam Walton started it, was all made, 100% made in the USA, and proud of it.
Yeah, I grew up in Southwest Missouri, so let's not talk too much about Sam Walton.
Okay. No, but my point is that, you know, our trade policies since then have done as much harm as has the stopping of the enforcement of the Sherman Act and of the granting of corporate personhood rights so that big box stores can claim 14th Amendment rights against discrimination, you know, which is nuts.
Tom, you're so absolutely right on. Right now, the local governments, the cities, the towns, the state governments aren't big enough, and I'm not even sure the federal government's big enough. But we've got to take back our individual rights from the corporations.
Yeah.
And may I make one side point with regard to the VA person you had on earlier?
Sure, Larry Scott.
Well, I'm a Vietnam vet, and frankly, I didn't see that North Vietnamese bullets or Agent Orange did a means testing on who they hit and who they affected.
Yeah. Well, this is why Larry was saying this is a bad thing, this whole
exactly.
Shirella Commission and James Peake and George Bush and Dick Cheney and all. I mean, the whole bunch of them trying to turn veterans' benefits basically into welfare benefits. I mean, it's nuts. Ralph, thank you very much for the call. Well said. Thank you. Chuck in Squamish. Please pronounce it, Chuck, Washington.
Suquamish, Washington.
Suquamish, thank you.
Yeah, I'm a 60% service-connected, disabled United States Marine Corps veteran, and I qualified for Chapter 31, which is a voc rehab benefit. But because I got a bachelor's degree, they figured I don't need any more schooling. And I qualified 2 years ago, and they said all that they will do is help me find a job, which they haven't done yet. But I took out a Stafford loan so I could go for my master's in public administration at the Evergreen State College. And just because these benefits, they say that they're there, or these entitlements that are there, you've got to wage war against the Department of Veterans Affairs. What I will say is my health care is covered by the VA, and there's a big difference between the VA medical system and the benefit and comp and pen and stuff like that for the other benefits. I feel pretty good about the care I get through my outpatient clinic in Bremerton. And
you like the socialized medicine of the Veterans Administration?
Yeah. It's really, matter of fact, I'm going in January 2nd for war traumas PTSD over in Seattle, and I've been up there before, and I've had my hip replaced by the Veterans Administration, and the care that they give me is great. But they're like a false curse.
You got to fight for them. Yep. No, I got it, Chuck. I got it. And that's the thing. They want to turn it into a welfare program, and this is the whole Dole Shalala Commission, and it's going to be a bad thing for veterans. 45 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270. So, Dick Cheney, it turns out, Dick Cheney is from the National Archives. This is the guy who said that he's not part of the executive branch. Why is he not part of the executive branch? Because there is a law that requires that the documents of the executive branch be archived in the National Security Archives. And the guy who was asking for that, the National Security Archives Information Security Oversight Office head guy, I don't know, what would you call this guy? He actually had a title. Director, ISOO Director, J. William Leonard, described as the gold standard of information specialists in the federal government, says he's now quitting his job. Why? Dick Cheney. This is incredible. This is from Newsweek, the current issue of Newsweek. He was asked, you know, what's going on? He says, so I wrote my letter to the Attorney General asking for a ruling that Cheney's office had to comply. In other words, that Cheney is part of the executive branch, the vice president is part of the executive branch, and they have to provide their papers. He said, then it was shortly after that that there were email recommendations from the office of the vice president's, the OVP, to the National Security Council Task Force to change the executive order that would effectively abolish my office. Newsweek, who wrote the emails? William Leonard. It was David Addington. That is Cheney's right-hand man. Newsweek, no explanation was offered. Leonard, no, it was strike this, strike that. Any place you saw the words, the director of ISOO or ISOO, it was struck. He goes on to talk about how this some of this had to do with the Valerie Plame investigation. A number of prosecution exhibits, this again from Newsweek, a number of prosecution exhibits in the Plame-related perjury trial of iScooter Libby, Cheney's former chief of staff. This is in brackets. I believe that the Center for American Progress over at thinkprogress.org added the bracketed information. Number of prosecution exhibits were annotated, handle as SCI. SCI is sensitive compartmentalized information, the most sensitive classified information there is. As I recall, one of them was the vice president and his staff were coming back from Norfolk, where they had attended a ship commissioning, and they were conferring on the plane about coming up with a media response plan to the allegations of Plame's husband, Iraq war critic Joe Wilson. That was one of the exhibits marked handled as SCI. Dick Cheney trying to do a cover-up, and in the process trying to fire the guys who are responsible for keeping track of what's going on. Amazing. Annie in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Annie, what's up?
Yes.
Happy Boxing Day.
Happy Boxing Day to you.
Thank you.
I was just kind of a little flip side on your conversation with the Walmart, on the Walmart conversation. I had a daughter who worked for Walmart for a while. She was paid $9.50 an hour. My sister-in-law, who worked for Babies R Us at the same period, was given...
I'm sorry, you broke up there. Was given what?
Oh, sorry. She was given minimum wage. Right. Both of them were, when they came up to their time for benefits, however, had their hours reduced so that they weren't making enough, they weren't working enough hours to get benefits. So when my daughter was making $9.50 at Walmart, my sister-in-law was only making $7.50. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who works for Bed Bath & Beyond, which, you know, is another one of the foo-foo places around here.
Sure.
She, again, was being paid only minimum wage. Her hours were also reduced when she came up to her probationary period was coming up and was going to come to the hours that she could have benefits. They were reduced again. So it's not just Walmart that does this to their employees. It's even the people who pay twice as much for their products are doing the same thing. The Starbucks conversation that you had, you realize that the ones that are in Safeway and other grocery stores, those people are, they're Safeway employees or the grocery store employees. They're not given the benefits that Starbucks gives their standalone employees.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yep. I have a niece who works for a Starbucks and a Safeway, and she is paid minimum wage and is given no benefits.
Huh. Interesting. Annie, thanks for the heads up and for the information. And happy holidays to you. Rebecca in Edmonds, Washington. Hey, Rebecca.
Hi there. All the topics you've talked about since 9 o'clock are related to why Dennis Kucinich is still working to impeach Dick Cheney, especially the last one. I mean, these cover-ups, I know we've heard about this a lot, but in Washington, our Washington for Impeachment group is still pushing on. We're still working and trying to persuade everybody to support Kucinich and to support impeachment. And what I really wanted to talk about earlier was the trade policies, the GATS and the FTAA and the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, and how opposed to all of these Kucinich has been. And now a lot of the other candidates are jumping on board, as if they were, you know, on that board all along. But I just want to remind people that the man who started impeachment has been consistently long-term against NAFTA, CAFTA, WTO, all of these things is Dennis Kucinich.
Dennis Kucinich is...
And thank you so much for talking about that earlier today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And happy Boxing Day.
Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you for the call. Dennis Kucinich has some marvelous positions on the issues, and Robert Wexler, I think, is doing a great job with his, you know, Wexler Wants Investigation or Wants Hearings.com, I believe is the website. He's calling for hearings into the crimes that have been committed that may be impeachable offenses. And, you know, I'm of two minds of this. On the one hand, you know, there's this part of me that says, hey, wait a minute, the crimes are pretty obvious, aren't they? Another part that says we've got to convince the American people, and that's going to take some theater. That's going to take some congressional investigations, you know, where it gets on TV. A third part of me says it won't make it on TV. We'll see. Coming up tomorrow, Marjorie Cohn, Tim Carpenter joining the program. I'm mobilizing the progressive vote, plus the best of the rest of the news. Don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.